Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we have a very special guest. We're going to talk about the paleo diet and the paleo lifestyle, but from an entirely different standpoint. You know, paleo is a term that's thrown around a lot these days. We've got the paleo diet, we've got paleo bars, we've got paleo shakes, we have paleo running groups here in New York City, and I even think there's a paleo dating site, if I'm not mistaken. So what's next? Paleo Survivor, a reality show on TV, or maybe a Broadway musical, I'm not sure. But certainly paleo is in the news. A lot of people are talking about paleo. But I came across this book, and I must say the vast majority of books that I receive as an interviewer, I either pass on, or maybe I glance at, or I speed read. This is a book that I found so compelling that I sat down, read it cover to cover, and not only that, I dog-eared it and annotated it and reread passages, and I just found it one of the most incredible expositions of the story of the human body. And in fact, that is its rather ambitious title. It's The Story of the Human Body, Evolution, Health, and Disease, by today's guest, who is a professor of evolutionary biology at Harvard. What a cool field. I personally studied anthropology, so this is right in my wheelhouse. It's sort of the intersection between medicine and anthropology paleontology. It's a very, very fascinating field. Dr. Daniel Lieberman is professor of human evolutionary biology, and he's also the Edwin Lerner II professor of biological sciences at Harvard. And he's written hundreds of articles, many appearing in major scientific journals like Nature and Science, and he's translated his research into a very, very readable and accessible book. He also has a personal interest, and we'll ask him about this, in the phenomenon of barefoot running. So he's been nicknamed the Barefoot Professor. We're going to find out about that in just a few moments. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast, Dr. Lieberman. It's nice having you here.
Well, thanks for having me.
So, first of all, you know, the question comes up, why go there? Why do we bother to study these things? Because evolutionary biology is an interesting story, but what are the lessons that it has for us in modern life?
Well, that's a great first question, because the reason I wrote this book is that I think many of us, including those of us who work in my field, have trouble figuring out how what happened in evolution is relevant to world today. And I wrote this book partly because I've been teaching human evolution for more than 20 years, and I teach anatomy and physiology as well. And of course, most of my students aren't going to be like me. They're going to be doctors or lawyers or whatever. And they're not so much interested in memorizing the brain sizes of this species or that species in terms of evolution, but they do want to know why their bodies are the way they are, and they also want to know why that is relevant to health, disease, illness, as well as other factors that affect us today. And then the other side of the coin is that I think there's a growing interest in evolution. You mentioned in your intro the paleo diet, you know, there's a reason that there's also a lot of skepticism about the paleo diet, and that's because it's actually quite a complex task to figure out how to use what happened in evolution and to think about evolution in a way that actually helps people. So
we really have to get it right. I mean, because you know, one man's paleo may be another man's just an act of the imagination.
Correct, and I think that. It's a complicated field, and it's evolution is not an easy topic. And what happened in human evolution is rather long and convoluted story. And applying that to life today is far from a trivial task. And so my attempt was to not only tell the story of the human body, but also try to relate it to the world today.
Well, yeah, and also, you know, many of your students at Harvard, I presume you teach both undergrads and graduate students, correct?
Correct.
But so you, that must be a great popular undergraduate course. But a lot of the folks in that course are not going to become scientists or academics. They're going to go into popular fields. Maybe many of them are pre-med. So do you think it's important for health professionals? You know, we study, I'm a physician. I went through regular medical school curriculum, but nowhere in my medical curriculum did I study the evolution of the human body. I studied pharmacology. I studied pathology. I studied histology. I studied anatomy. But with no way of relating it to how we evolved.
Right. Well, and I think that's a huge mistake. There's a very famous expression by the great geneticist Theodosius Dobzhansky that nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution. And I would argue that also applies to medicine. Nothing in biology and medicine makes sense except in the light of evolution, because after all, everything about our bodies is the way it is because of interactions between genes that evolved over many, many, many thousands, millions, even billions of generations, and the environments in which we now live. And you cannot understand how things work and why we get sick and why we're healthy unless you understand evolution. And furthermore, we're in a pickle today, right? On the one hand, people are living longer than ever. Human health is arguably never been better than it is before. Infant mortality rates in places like the United States are less than 1%. Yet at the same time, we're suffering from a growing epidemic of non-infectious diseases that range from osteoporosis and type 2 diabetes to autoimmune diseases. And those diseases have an evolutionary origin. And solving them is not, the solution to these diseases is not to pretend we're cavemen and go back to some kind of fantasized Paleolithic, but rather to understand how and why we get sick, what are our adaptations, what are we not adapted for, and how the concept of adaptation is even relevant to modern life. And furthermore, it also helps us think about evaluate alternative strategies to dealing with these problems that we currently face.
Well, you introduce a very important term in your book, and you come back to it repeatedly, and that's the term evolutionary mismatch. What is an evolutionary mismatch? And give us some examples of a mismatch of our genes, our evolutionary heritage to our current environmental conditions.
So a mismatch disease is it's a term that was not invented by me, but it's in the evolutionary medicine literature. So evolutionary medicine is a new growing field that applies evolution to health and disease. And a mismatch disease is basically a disease that's caused by an unfortunate interaction. It's the body being imperfectly or poorly adapted to modern environmental conditions. And there are many examples of mismatch, and they can range from, for example, not having enough physical activity can lead to osteoporosis, being a white, very light-skinned, fair-skinned person from England who suddenly gets put on a boat and sent to Australia with the baking sun there, and you're much more likely to get skin cancer.
A dark-skinned person who lives in Detroit.
That's correct.
Like the D deficiency.
Right. Many, many examples of mismatch. And the hypothesis is that many of these mismatch diseases are of relatively recent origin. Some of them started with the origins of the agricultural revolution, when we started to grow food and shift our diets, but even more importantly, when we started to live in crowded settlements with lots of high population densities and poor sanitation, which led to the rise of many infectious diseases that lowered the health quality of many people ever since the Neolithic, since the Stone Age ended. Also diseases that came from animals that we domesticated and lived with. And then a whole new set of these diseases has arisen because of modern industrialization, from pollution, from lack of exercise and physical activity, from because of our elevators and cars and things like that, and even from lack of sleep because we stay up too late watching television.
Well, some people who don't really understand the evolutionary process believe that we'll evolve to adapt to some of these new modern circumstances. We'll become big-headed individuals with brains, three times the size of our current brains. We'll develop special paddles on our fingers to operate mobile devices and text faster. But is it a misconception that we can evolve to adapt to our current modern circumstances?
Well, I say this with a sense of humor, but God only knows what's going to happen in the future. You know, natural selection can only happen if you have several criteria. First of all, you have to have heritable variations that, and in addition, those heritable variations have to have an effect on your reproductive success. So if it turns out to be the case that there are individuals who have bigger brains and that helps them have more offspring than those of us with smaller brains, then yes, indeed, natural selection will lead towards larger brains.
But it actually seems to work in reverse. That particular example that you cited, you know, people who are more prosperous, more upscale, they tend to have, you know, 1.7 children on average. And then
yes, but that natural selection can only act on them if there's a genetic basis for them having fewer children. So yes, it's true that people who are well off tend to have fewer offspring than people who are less well off.
But it isn't necessarily a reflection of their genes. That is not a genetic.
That's not going to cause any evolutionary change unless there's an evolutionary basis for the fact that rich people are rich, which I strongly would vociferously argue with. So that's not a cause of evolutionary change. But there is evolution going on today. There's no question that, for example, infectious diseases are a major cause of evolution. Natural selection hasn't stopped. It's just that natural selection is operating at the rate it always works. It's fairly slow. It's going to take, you know, dozens, hundreds, thousands of generations for us to understand what's going on now, how that's going to affect our species later on. And for most of us who are interested in type 2 diabetes and cancer, the diseases that affect us, our loved ones, our children, our grandchildren, it's just not an acceptable option to wait for natural selection to solve the problem.
Well, you also introduced a term, I believe it's the term that you've developed. It's called disevolution. What's that all about?
Well, disevolution is really the flip side of the coin of mismatched diseases. So we get mismatched diseases because of inadequate adaptation to our environments. But what do we do as a species? We're very good at treating the symptoms of many diseases. After all, medicine, probably for thousands of years, people went to shamans in the Paleolithic, right, to get their toothaches or headaches dealt with. We do the same thing today, and we relieve the symptoms. But this evolution is a feedback loop in which we, by treating the symptoms so effectively, we fail to address the causes. And what that does is it enables the disease to become more common or more severe or simply remain very prevalent.
So we may be perpetuating our problems.
We are perpetuating our problems. It's why so many of these graphs are rising or staying flat. A good example would be flat feet. Now, flat feet are caused by an interaction between your genes and your environment, just like every other problem people have today. But I can tell you, as somebody who works with barefooted populations around the world, that the environmental shift that's caused an epidemic of flat feet is shoes. We have weak feet, basically. Weak feet lead to a, either inadequate development of the arch or the arch gets weak and collapses.
So you're suggesting that those kids that we buy those ultra expensive sneakers for, the ones that, you know, sometimes have those little lights that go on, they're so exciting for kids, that having well-shod kids and using, you know, all this marvelous running technology that we have so that we can run on hard pavement, that this actually has caused us problems?
Well, no, you've oversimplified it. I'm not opposed to shoes, but maybe shoes that have very stiff soles.
Mm-hmm.
Shoes that have arch supports. Those essentially enable us to promote weak feet and an increase in the persistence of the prevalence of flat feet. But we don't pass on flat feet to our children. We pass on the shoes, which then keep the cycle going. Another example is myopia, right? Myopia is caused by lack of exposure.
By the way, you just mentioned two conditions I suffer from, flat feet, and I was one of the first kids in my class to have glasses and braces, and probably you're going to tell me that orthodontics is as a result of disevolution.
Orthodontics is also an example of disevolution, but it's not all bad. I mean, for example, myopia is often perpetuated or caused or exacerbated by a lot of reading. Now, I'm surely, you know, if somebody writes things, right, I'm not going to say we should stop our children from reading. Sometimes we pay the price for this feedback loop, and if glasses are the price we have to pay for transmission of information visually on the printed page, so be it. But other forms of disevolution, type 2 diabetes, cancer, you know, There's a lot of hypothesized ones. We need much more evidence for some of them. But you know, heart disease is clearly a mismatched disease. Much of it is that you know we're paying an enormous price. We spend $2.7 trillion in the United States on medical bills on medicine every year, and it's estimated that approximately 70% of those expenses goes towards diseases that are preventable. Or 70% of diseases that people have are preventable, right? I mean, I would argue that, heart disease is an almost completely preventable disease.
Well, recently,
a third of Americans.
Recently, in fact, they made a big fuss of the fact, and I remember the headlines very clearly, that while we think of heart disease as a modern disease, doctors and researchers are very excited to excavate mummies on which they performed calcium scoring, you know, just in the same way we take live humans and do calcium scoring. And they found that many of these mummies had atherosclerosis. So they said this is proof positive that the human condition is beset with degenerative disease and that it is our natural susceptibility to get cardiovascular disease. Nothing new here. We need to develop more powerful drugs like Lipitor, statin drugs, to prevent cardiovascular disease. I mean, that was the conclusion of a lot of these articles.
That's right.
I think I know what you're going to say in relationship to that.
Yeah, well, what I didn't mention was that atherosclerosis is not actually necessary. It is part of the cycle of heart disease, but there's no evidence that these people actually had heart disease, that they died of it. Furthermore, it wasn't in the coronary arteries of these mummies. And there's plenty of evidence from hunter-gatherers which show that they don't get hypertension, and there's no evidence that they do get heart disease. So, you know, we have to be very critical of the literature and how it's used.
Right. What you have to do is compare what is called the Neolithic lifestyle to the Paleolithic lifestyle. So help us out with that, because you go into detail about the farming revolution in your book.
Yeah. So, well, I mean, even going back to these hunter-gatherers, right, even if they did have some calcium deposits in their arteries, they didn't have them in the arteries that tend to cause heart disease, and there's no evidence from that diagnosis that these individuals had heart disease. I mean, everybody has to die of something, right? Hunter-gatherers as well. And there's no evidence that people in the Paleolithic led completely blessed, perfect lives. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the problem with the paleo diet, right? And there are many people who are skeptical of it, and I'm one of them, because it's a very simplistic approach towards evolutionary medicine, right? People in the Paleolithic did get sick. They did die. And there was no one kind of Paleolithic life. And even more importantly, you have to remember that humans aren't adapted to be healthy. We're adapted to have lots of offspring, who then in turn have more offspring.
I think that's a very important statement, and that's something that I drew from your book, is that, you know, we tend to think that the state of optimal health is wellness, freedom from pain, freedom from any disease. And what you're saying is that our evolutionary heritage is that we often feel pain, we're susceptible to medical conditions, we're favored to be able to reproduce, but beyond that, the rest is gravy.
That's right, which is why you have to be really skeptical of very simplistic paleo diet ideas, because remember, just because somebody did it in the Paleolithic doesn't mean it's good for your health.
Okay.
That's nonsense. It's obviously ridiculous, right? And hunter-gatherers get sick too. They get respiratory infections. They die from violence. They die from, but it's nonetheless true that there are a lot of diseases today, like these mismatched diseases, to which they are less susceptible, to which our bodies are less adapted. So there is also some truth and some important lessons to be learned from thinking about the paleo diet. It's just, one has to be really thoughtful about it, and careful about it. So going back to the question you asked earlier about heart disease. There is no question that with the origins of farming, diets changed, right? And people started eating.
That was approximately when?
Well, at different parts of the world at
yep.
different times. So in the Middle East, for example, around 10,000 years ago, around the same time in Asia, in East Asia, more recently in the New World, in say Mesoamerica or North America. So it was invented at least seven times in different places. But even in the oldest parts of the world, it was about 600 generations ago. But since then, so there are many people who believe in the paleo diet who think, well, okay, since we all, our ancestors more than 600 generations ago only ate, hunted and gathered food and they didn't grow cereals, nobody today should eat cereals. Well, there's two problems with that. First, there's no question there's been a lot of selection since the origins of agriculture to help some people in some populations cope with carbohydrate metabolism. There are many genes that have been under selection since then.
With the emphasis being on some populations and some genetic variants, which are expressed in some people more than others. In other words, different strokes for different folks, depending on your origins, which are in this modern age very hard to trace.
Well, I mean, I think most people know whether they're European or whatever. But anyway, that's I agree with you. There's also evolution for lactose persistence. So my ancestors, for example, evolved genes that enabled me to drink milk as an adult. Now, just because cavemen didn't drink milk as adults doesn't mean I shouldn't. After all, my ancestors experienced natural selection so that I still can. And I'm not giving up cheese, I'll tell you that. So it's complicated, right? And there's no simple one-size-fits-all solution, and there's no such thing from an evolutionary perspective of optimal health. Because, again, natural selection pushes us towards having more offspring who then survive to have more offspring. So we're only selected to be healthy insofar as health promotes reproduction. So going again back to the case that you mentioned again, that diets shifted profoundly with the origins of agriculture, and that led to a variety of novel diseases that people still suffer from. But there's a flip side, right? What agriculture did give people was also more energy. So people were able to have more offspring. So hunter-gatherers have offspring every 3 years or so. Farmers can have offspring every sort of 1.5 to 2, even faster sometimes, years. So farmer and the infant mortality rate for farmers and hunter-gatherers is probably about the same in most places. I mean, it's lots of variations. I'm giving a broad brush here. So farming may have led to some diseases, but it also led to an increase in the number of children people were able to have, who then went on to have more children. So everything is a trade-off. There's no such thing as a simple, there's no such thing as optimality from an evolutionary perspective. It's a quixotic, non-existent parameter.
So what you're saying is nature is agnostic as to whether we feel good, and so some of the aches and pains and diseases we were prey to were just part of our evolutionary makeup.
They're adaptations. So pain is an adaptation. Nausea is an adaptation. Lots of diseases have their origins in aspects of our anatomy and physiology that are actually adaptations.
Mm-hmm. So you even extend this to certain psychological conditions like anxiety or obsessive compulsive disorder or attention deficit disorder, that these are actually evolutionary adaptations that find a mismatch in a modern setting.
Yeah, that's the hypothesis. I'm less of an expert on those aspects of biology, but absolutely, yeah. I mean, we're adapted to, from an evolutionary perspective, I would imagine that sometimes being, depressed or anxious or nervous are all adaptations to help you survive danger. The problem is that today we live in environments where what were used to be hopefully short-lived responses become chronic and they lead to serious problems. But furthermore, there's no question that the body is a highly integrated set of highly integrated systems. So, for example, individuals who are don't get enough physical activity are much more prey to a wide range of mental health diseases than individuals who get plenty of physical activity. So I would imagine that diseases like ADHD and depression and anxiety are more common today, not just because of the social environments in which we live, but also because people are more stressed and get less exercise. And those lead to higher rates the staggering array of diseases.
Let's take a segue to your personal interest and professional interest in the human foot and the barefoot running. They call you the barefoot professor up at Harvard. Can you be seen loping along the streets of Boston, unshod?
I enjoy to run barefoot occasionally. Yep. I usually wear minimal shoes, but I'll take my shoes off when it's nice weather. Absolutely. I've become quite. I started studying barefoot running many years ago. We published a paper in the journal Nature. We being me and a guy named Dennis Bramble, who's a professor at the University of Utah, and we published a paper that was on the cover of Nature entitled "Born to Run," in which we argued that humans evolved to run long distances about 2 or so million years ago. Mm-hmm. And of course, we obviously evolved to run barefoot. And so, soon thereafter, we started studying barefoot runners and bringing them into the lab. And of course, various people came, including a fellow, Chris McDougall, who then wrote the popular book,
Born to Run.
Run.
Yeah.
And, so
you coined that phrase in a scientific paper.
Well, I think we used it on the cover of Nature. I think Bruce Springsteen got there before us.
okay,
it was actually
right.
Because of that Bruce Springsteen has yet to visit my lab, but Chris McDougall came and that helped, it's written about in his book. But the important point is that we obviously evolved to run barefoot, so we started to study habitual barefoot runners because most of the research that had been done on barefoot running was just basically asking college students to take their shoes off in the lab. So we started bringing in dedicated habitual barefoot runners and studying them in the field and realized that what's really important about barefoot running are, I think, two things. First is that people who go unshod tend to have stronger feet than people who wear shoes. We already talked about that. But more importantly, when you're not wearing a shoe, particularly a shoe with all that cushioning and stuff in it, it's just you and the ground, and you learn to run lightly and gently. So you had mentioned earlier, and you were talking about running on hard pavement, and you uttered one of the standard misconceptions about barefoot running, which is that the hardness of the surface you're running on is relevant.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you as a barefoot runner that one of the first things that people learn is that that's actually not true, and we worked out the physics, because when you run with what I would consider a classical barefoot style, called a forefoot strike, you actually generate no impact peak. So when your body hits the ground, there's no collisional force. There's no rapid exchange of momentum between the body and the ground. So if you were to get up right now...
More like gliding across the surface with a light forefoot touch.
Well, just for example, if you were to get up now and jump, how would you land?
On my forefoot, because it would hurt my heels.
The foot. Right. Yeah, and you'd land gently, and you wouldn't make a huge thump, and nobody in the floor below you would hear you. But if you land on your heel, it would make a huge crash, because when you land on your heel, mm-hmm. you exchange more momentum. Remember, momentum is mass times velocity with the ground. So, and that generates an impulse, which then hits back at you with equal and opposite force. So barefoot runners learn very quickly that it hurts to land hard on their heel, and they learn to run gently and lightly. And so it doesn't matter how hard the pavement is. Some of the best surfaces to run on are hard but smooth. What barefoot runners love is smooth. That's what they care about. So Central Park, for example, is one of my favorite places on the planet to run barefoot on the outer path, because it's a wonderful, smooth tarmac. It's perfect for barefoot running. It doesn't matter in the slightest.
So in your discussion of human evolution, you actually state that humans aren't the greatest runners, that we're slower than a lot of animals. In fact, chimpanzees for short distances can outcharge us. They're faster. They basically have a four-limbed running style. And by being upright, we slow down. But you say that this is actually part of our evolutionary heritage that we retain, that we can do long-distance running, and that it's actually good for us to do that.
Well, evolution is a contingent process, right? Everything happens because of what happened previously. And we didn't have to become long-distance endurance runners. But again, everything is kind of trade-off. So when we became bipeds, probably around 6 or 7 million years ago,
standing up on 2 feet.
Right. Yeah. So we there were some benefits, and that may have been increased economy, for example, of walking. So we were able to walk long distances to get food for less energy than, say, an ape, an ancestor. But the disadvantage is that we became more unstable, and we also became less speedy. With only two legs, you basically run half as fast as somebody with four legs. But our early ancestors probably had to sprint away from, animals that were chasing them. But it wasn't until around 2.5 million years ago when we see the evidence that we became selected for endurance running, running really long distances. So though the fastest human beings in the world, like Usain Bolt, are not particularly fast compared to other mammals, long distance runners can outrun horses over long distances, particularly when it's hot. And we evolved that in order to hunt. So our evolutionary origins are as endurance athletes. I think that if you were to look at the human body, although how our ancestors used their bodies, surely they did power sports. Occasionally they would, for powerful things, they had to climb trees or dig holes, etc. But what we really excel at as a species is endurance, walking long distances, and also occasionally running long distances. And that's why humans, who don't engage in endurance physical activity on a regular basis get sick.
Right, because we're not utilizing our natural equipment. No,
it's not that. It's that we're not adapted to not use them. So
okay.
I
see the distinction. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Just like, for example, we're adapted to, like many animals, to add on fat whenever possible.
Mm-hmm.
Fat is an important energy reserve. There was no point in our evolutionary history where we became adapted to get rid of excess fat. That was never a selection pressure we ever faced.
Right. There's not an evolutionary drive to look like a fashion model in the 21st century. I mean,
it's not even evolutionary drive. There was never selection in the past for ancestors to lose excess weight. So we never evolved. Had the adaptations, you know, the genetic variants existed, we never evolved those adaptations because there was never a selective benefit for it in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Hence, we're stuck with bodies that never figured out how to deal with this problem because the problem didn't exist. The same token, we never evolved to cope with physical inactivity because our ancestors never had to cope with physical inactivity. There were no, your great 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 grandparents, even in the period of farming, right, in the Neolithic, you know, the farmers still have to work hard. There was no period in human evolution until after the Industrial Revolution was invented that people were able to live all day long without ever getting their heart rate up. And so as a result, we never evolved adaptations to cope with inactivity.
Well, comment, please, on humans' fat-storing capabilities, because you cite a very interesting fact. You know, gorillas, I mean, sometimes you look at gorillas and you go, wow, those are gorillas, they're, you know, they're pretty husky looking. But actually, you state that gorillas the apes that we may have descended from did not have the ability to store fat as well as humans, and that there's a reason for that, that it was actually an exquisite evolutionary adaptation.
Well, actually, gorillas can get very fat in zoos. So chimps and gorillas in zoos get just as fat as humans, and they get diabetes and all kinds of other horrible diseases. They just don't get the opportunity to get that fat in zoos, and being fat is not normal for them. So the evidence is that primates and apes get up to about maybe a maximum of about 5 or 6% body fat. I think that's the maximum that people have recorded. I also want to add that there's not enough good data from wild primates.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, I don't think anybody doubts that humans, even skinny humans, are much fatter than primates. So typical hunter-gatherers will be 10 to 20% body fat. That's a minimum. And of course, many people today are well above that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because we are exquisitely adapted to be even more fat than other animals in our natural environment. So we're talking hunter-gatherers. Again, if you put a gorilla in a zoo and you feed it what you feed
it's a different ballgame, yeah.
It'll get fat as well. So, but we are importantly adapted to be fat because it's part of our reproductive strategy. It's part of our ability to feed large brains, which are very expensive. It's part of our adaptations to pay for the cost of lactation, which is extremely expensive. So fat played a special role in human evolution. I mean, think about the other animals that tend to be fat. They're marine mammals that have blubber to keep them warm, or animals that hibernate. They get fat before they sleep for months, right? And that, again, they're storing energy. And we're the other group of fat mammals out there, and we're special. So when people get overweight, you know, one thing we should never do is blame them, because they're actually doing what their bodies evolved to do, which is to add, you know, store fat when possible. And it's just that they're having to make decisions in environments for which we never evolved to cope with. And we've created these obesogenic environments, but people's bodies are still behaving as they used to.
How about our proclivity to seek calories in all the wrong places?
Well, again, you know, if you're a hunter-gatherer, you know what the most sought-after food is among hunter-gatherers?
I think you said it was honey.
Yes, correct. They love honey more than anything else. Meat is
but tough
two.
To find. You'd have to trek, you know, miles and miles and miles, maybe climb a tree or you know, do a dangerous have a dangerous encounter with bees. So you worked pretty hard to get that honey.
That's correct, and there's also just not that much honey out there in most parts of the world.
So, unlimited amounts.
Yes, so honey was a special treat. So
they didn't have 7-Elevens then.
That's correct. So the estimates are that hunter-gatherers, you know, there's their crude estimates, but now we got about 6 to 8, maybe, you know, pounds of sugar a year, if you actually boiled it down and measured the number of pounds of sugar. Whereas your average American eats about 100 pounds of sugar a year. And the thing is also is that most of the sugars that our bodies used to get came in the form of fruits that in which the sugar is wrapped up in in cells, right? They're cell walls that have to be broken out and to get the sugar, so it comes with fiber. We now get sugar without fiber because processing of food removes the fiber because fiber tends to spoil, so we get rid of it. And so we now get this double whammy. We get not only, you know, we evolved to love sugar, so a sweet tooth is a very intrinsic, basic human adaptation. It's there's no question that we evolved to love sweet things. If you put a piece of celery and a piece of chocolate cake in front of me, I will definitely go for the chocolate cake, and that's normal, and I'd be, you know, a total liar to say otherwise. And then you combine that sugar with no fiber, no digestible fiber, and so what happens, the fiber that's intrinsic to the food. And the result is that we not only get a lot too much sugar, but we also get it too fast. When the sugar hits our bloodstream and our livers at that dosage and at that rate, our metabolisms can't cope, and then we end up shunting it into our livers and getting fatty liver syndrome. We end up turning it into fat, which then gets spread throughout our bloodstream and cause cardiac, you know, arterial hardening and you know, visceral belly fat, which is much more hormone sensitive, and you know, a whole litany of problems that leads to the diseases that we worry about, including, you know, even mental health diseases.
Mm-hmm. And cancer as well as a possible consequence of that. Now, the concept you were talking about, the release, the time release of sugar, sometimes referred as GI, glycemic index, or GL, glycemic load. Talk to us about what our primitive ancestors ate in terms of the types of fruits and vegetables which were available. How do they compare to domesticated fruits and vegetables, like, you know, a big ear of Middle West corn or, you know, a succulent orange that we get from Florida?
Yeah. Again, I think we shouldn't demonize domesticated fruits and vegetables. Yes, it is true that wild fruits and vegetables have higher amounts of fiber and lower amounts of sugar. So, you know, most of the foods that you can get out, you know, pick from the wild in places like Africa, I do this occasionally because I work there. You know, they're not very sweet. They're as sweet as a carrot. And most wild foods are very high in fiber. When we domesticated foods, we selected them often for the properties that we like, right? Lots of sugar, lots of sweet, lots of starch, and lower amounts of fiber. Now, I've never heard of anybody dying from eating a lot of fruit, you know. We sometimes, again, maybe react a little bit too strongly in terms of the Paleolithic sort of analogy. There's no question that eating whole fruits are healthy.
Mm-hmm. Healthier than guzzling juice, fruit juice.
Well, juice is like soda. There's nothing good about juice. Unless you're about to die of scurvy, and then go ahead and have some juice. But otherwise, avoid it like you would avoid soda. But yes, we do eat domesticated foods that are lower in fiber and higher in sugar, but they're not that bad. I mean, it's not like eating, you know, stuff that you buy in the frozen food aisle sometimes, I'm not sure if one has to go all the way back to eating wild foods to be healthy. And there are plenty of, you know, people who grew up in the Mediterranean world who live to be old and happy, right? And they're eating domesticated foods. We shouldn't demonize domesticated foods. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't demonize fat. But we have to be sensible about how we use them and how we process them and how we cook them and how much of them we eat. There's no question that there have been benefits to agriculture. It's not all been downhill ever since the origins of farming.
Right, because otherwise we take sort of a Rousseauian romanticized view of the primitive, and you've been out in the field, and you know that life can be tough, challenging, and gruesome for people who are barely subsisting on what the environment provides.
And furthermore, how are we going to? We have 7 billion people on the planet today. How are we going to feed them without using domesticated foods? Right?
Mm-hmm.
We can't feed them all grass-fed food and wild, you know, picked berries.
Wild-crafted food. Yeah,
it's not going to happen. But the good news is that you can eat domesticated fruits and be very healthy. I've never heard of anybody who died from eating, mm-hmm. you know, lots of fruit. And in fact, the evidence is that people who eat lots of fruit are much healthier than people who don't. So again, one doesn't have to go totally paleo to be healthy.
Well, so the book, I mean, in a way, the book paints a bit of a grim picture because, you know, we are in evolutionary mismatch in a variety of ways. So what are some of the ways that we can, you know, individuals who are zealous might read this book, people who are really into this might pursue the types of lifestyles that in some ways superficially resemble our genetic inheritance. But
can I disagree with you here? I actually don't think it's such a grim picture. After all, we're actually doing really well today.
Okay.
People are living to their 70s or 80s. You're not going to die from all the horrible infectious diseases that your grandparents were concerned of. We have adequate, you know, you can walk down the street and get all kinds of nutrient supplements. You can get whatever you want. You can go to Whole Foods or some other supermarket and get an incredible range of fruits and vegetables. What we're suffering from are diseases that are often diseases that we've created but through our environments that we can modify. It's actually not that hard to use the evidence we have from evolution to make modest changes that will lead to huge benefits in personal and public health.
So it's a matter of awareness and also converting this into some kind of societal imperative to do the right thing.
That's correct. I mean, basically, you know, you could transform the public health landscape today by simply getting people to exercise more, be more physically active, at the same time reducing the amount of foods that are processed, especially with sugars. You did those two things, right? If you just got rid of processed sugar or just decreased the amount of processed sugar in food and got people to exercise, just think of what the effect would be on public health in the United States.
So, unfortunately, we have some perverse incentives because even the food stamp program, which is very well-meaning and very important for some people who just don't have enough money to buy food, ends up promoting obesity because it subsidizes all manner of foods, some foods which are obesogenic, and some studies show that people who are in the SNAP program, the Supplemental Nutrition Program, in general are heavier and more insulin resistant.
That's correct, because they're eating an unhealthy diet, and they're also probably too, marathon running has become, you know, a big, huge trend, but it's usually among wealthy people who have the time to train. And so, yes, there's a lot of grim statistics out there about rising levels of obesity and rising levels of type 2 diabetes and all that, and my book is full of all that grim information, but on the other hand, the solutions are political solutions, right? That's the problem. It's a lack of political will, not a lack of know-how. We actually know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, where and how can we get the will to help people act in their own self-interest?
Well, we're subsidizing high fructose corn syrup instead of subsidizing broccoli. That's sort of the way our economy rolls.
That's correct. So I would say that it's really a political problem more than anything else. And the bad news is, well, our political system is completely broken at the moment,
yeah,
what's going on today. But the good news is it's still just a political solution problem. And actually, ultimately, I think it can and will be tackled when all of a sudden, when it becomes evident to that it's actually in our national economic self-interest, and it's even in our self-interest of self-defense. Right, you know, it's hard for the army.
National security. It's a matter of national security. Yeah.
Get recruits that are even, you know, healthy enough to be members of the army. That's actually a problem with the military these days. There's a certain tipping point, and perhaps we're going to reach it soon, when the voices that are pushing, unhealthy food on each other, but also the environments that we've created that prevent physical activity we can roll them back. I mean, for example, physical activity in schools, right? We could do a huge amount to improve public health by simply requiring, actually requiring proper physical activity in schools, right? We used to do it. We don't do it anymore. How difficult would it really actually be to solve that problem? Just vote out all those bums on the school board who basically prevent physical activity from being more important, and let's replace them with those who actually understand that not only is important for the long-term health of all those children, but also for their short-term mental health and their performance in school. There's no trade-off whatsoever between physical activity and performance in school. Actually, they work together in a synergistic fashion.
Well, absolutely. Well, you know, I'm sure glad that the future leaders of America have an opportunity to be exposed to the information that you share with them. and that you share in this book, The Story of the Human Body, Evolution, Health, and Disease. And Dr. Lieberman, I think you're going to be appearing in New York City. So many of our listeners are in New York City. You're going to be at the Museum of Natural History.
That's right, in November.
Great. And if people just go to the website of the Museum of Natural History, they can find out where they can see you in person, correct?
Thank you. Yeah, I think it's November 6th or 7th. I can't remember exactly.
Great. Yeah, I think that's going to be very exciting. And I recommend very highly that you get a copy of The Story of the Human Body, Evolution, Health, and Disease. And it's very readable, accessible, lots of scientific facts, everything you wanted to know about human evolution, but also with an emphasis on how it relates to the diseases, the health problems that we now face. And, you know, I'm also going to, Dr. Lieberman, write a review of your book for our listeners. I'll post it on our website, and it'll be available via our Intelligent Medicine newsletter. So look for that, and I'll send it out. I hope it gets some eyeballs.
Thank you very much. It was a real pleasure to talk to you.
It was my pleasure. Keep up the great work. Thanks for joining us on today's edition of Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Talk to you next time.